Riddle me this. What came first, the science or the sci-fi? Well, it's time to smuggle in your popcorn and outside drink. On this episode of the Oxford Sparks Big Questions podcast, we're going to the movies. And this week we're asking, what does Hollywood get right and wrong when science is in the storyline? Hello, it's me again, Emily Elias, and this is the show where we seek out the brightest minds at the University of Oxford, and this time round, you are in for an absolute treat. We have got a series of familiar voices from this past series of the podcast, and I've asked them to play the role of film critic and scientist. Up first...
Dark side. A Jedi. They're real.
I hope that music sounds familiar to you. It does to Dr. Neil Ashton with the Oxford E-Research Center. He studies the facts and figures of how you make aircrafts cut through turbulence and all things aerodynamic. So, I asked him about, what else? Star Wars. And does the design of the Millennium Falcon and the X-Wing make sense?
Yeah, I think that's the people who, you know, were drawing this, the people, were looking at examples on Earth, essentially, of what fighter jets look like. And so obviously a fighter jet has to look a certain way because of the aerodynamics. It's flying through the air, has to, you know... be able to go fast and have all the performance characteristics that it needs. But none of them go in space, obviously. So interestingly, then when they go, let's make some space fighter jet type things, X-Wings, they put them with the same wings and the same kind of look that they would have on Earth, where there is no air in space, so they don't need to look, there is no aerodynamics, so to speak. If it's just staying in space, they don't need to look like that. So,
could the Millennium Falcon take off and land on a planet with a similar atmosphere to Earth?
No, I'm no expert on Star Wars, so I'm not entirely sure of like how much it weighs and all that. But if you think about the rockets that go to the moon and things like that, I mean, they're sending up something like a capsule, which weighs maybe a couple of ton or something like that. But the rocket is unbelievably big, isn't it? And all it's taking is this little thing. So you need so much power to lift anything out of the Earth. Any sort of like, you know, big spaceship, if it was to try and get out of the atmosphere, it would need some sort of power that, yeah, we don't currently have, basically.
Sticking with space, remember Colin Wilson? He's our atmospheric physicist at the University of Oxford who has spent the last 17 years or so trying to get his wind sensor on Mars. If you don't remember him, go check out the episode. It's great. Well, with all of his research into the Red Planet, he has a bit of a critique on not just one, but two journeys back to Earth.
At the beginning of the Martian film, if you've seen it, there's a great big dust storm and... like a sort of dust hurricane, and all the it's going to topple the rocket, and so they have to leap into the rocket and go off to space before their rocket gets toppled over.
Ready?
And you're going to say, this is it.
Watch out! Ready!
This is how I end.
Commander, Mark is dead.
We have to go now.
But the atmosphere on Mars is such low density that even if you have winds of 100 miles an hour or so, it won't push your rocket over. Now, the author has recognized that this is artistic license which he took. He needed some crisis for the astronauts to escape from. But yeah, so that is not scientifically accurate. But something which annoyed me much more was there was a film called Gravity. So there, special effects, brilliant. The script was cringeworthy because you have these highly, highly trained astronauts who go through years and years of training to understand, you know, all the systems, the mechanics of their spacecraft. And when something goes wrong in the film with their spacecraft, they just sort of sit back and start discussing their childhood and things like this, which is so completely unrealistic. These are trained engineers. The first thing they would do is start analyzing what's gone wrong, what can they do, what can they test, and they didn't do that at all in the film. So that was really disappointing. And I thought, you know, the George Clooney character being really condescending to another astronaut who's gone through vast amounts of training, that would not float, as it were.
Back down here on Earth, there is one sci-fi film that missed my radar completely. 1996's Chain Reaction, starring Keanu Reeves and Morgan Freeman.
Your experiment just got a mind of its own.
Here's the brief from IMDb. Two researchers in a green alternative energy project are put on the run when they are framed for murder and treason. Professor Eleanor Stride, remember her? She's figuring out a way to deliver cancer drugs through bubbles. Well, she's got a beef with one of the main plot points in Chain Reaction, the bubble.
I need to set the scene. So there was an experiment published probably about 20 years ago now, where some scientists claimed that if you have a bubble and you expand it to a huge degree and then allow it to collapse very, very violently, the compression of the gas inside can potentially create nuclear fusion. The temperatures and the pressures inside that bubble are sufficient for nuclear fusion. Now, if you do the maths, this is absolutely true. Theoretically, these pressures and temperatures are ridiculously huge. They are hotter than the sun. This is absolutely true. And theoretically, you can get fusion. Unfortunately, there were some serious problems with the experiments that they reported. The measurement technique they used was the same as the thing they were detecting, and there were all sorts of problems with it. And so the whole community went crazy. Half the people were like, yeah, of course this is happening. This is amazing. It's going to solve the energy crisis. And the other half were, this is a complete load of rubbish. To be honest, it's not been resolved, but they made a movie about it.
Amazing.
And it's really quite painful. It's not the best film ever made anyway, and the way the science is presented is just absolutely agonizing. It's hard to say what they got wrong because we don't know what the real science is, so, you know, it maybe it does work. There are people still researching this who genuinely think it's going to be a solution to the energy crisis, and I'm not going to say they're wrong because we don't know. But it's quite surprising they made one about this because it's a fairly niche area. But I say it was a big controversy in the US over these experiments. You know, a lot of people got very, very upset, and there were a lot of lawyers running around suing each other. So
I think they should have just like made a film about the controversial experiment, but that is just me. Okay, let's look for the positive. Who is getting science right? Well, Dr. Jason Nurse from Oxford's computer science department is having a love affair with the TV program Mr. Robot.
Hello, friend. Hello, friend. That's lame. Maybe I should give you a name. But that's a slippery slope. You're only in my head. We have to remember that.
If you haven't seen it, let me break it down for you. Rami Malek plays a computer programmer named Elliot, who's leading a double life. By day, he works as a cybersecurity engineer for a big giant company. And by night, he's playing a vigilante hacker who's helping bring down corporate America, including, yes, the company he is paid to protect.
This is the world we live in. The warm, messy circle of humanity.
I think it's just a really good capture of what actually happens in security, what actually happens in kind of security companies. It tries to keep a line, you know, directly along, you know, what happens, what could happen, the type of attacks, how people might attack. It kind of really does a pretty good job of capturing that side of things. And also, I think it's it also covers the kind of hacktivist angle. So everyone would know about Anonymous and you know, Lizard Squad and these type of people, and LulzSec and these type of people. But what this tries to do is also try to kind of pull that out even more. It's really all about, you know, it's about hacking, it's about cybersecurity, it's about kind of a drama, it's a thriller. And it tries to focus on this guy and his perspective and generally kind of Mr. Robot. I won't speak about it too much, especially if people haven't watched it, but definitely the end of season one, must watch.
How do we know if we're in control?
Sticking with computers, a few episodes ago, you heard me talking with Ingmar Posner about how to teach a machine how to drive. And with his expertise in artificial intelligence, I felt like it was only natural to quiz him about the best film series over sentient machines trying to kill off the human race. Terminator. Very
careful. Come with me if you want to live.
Will the machines take over?
No. So there's a really nice quote by, I think, a guy called Andrew Ng, right, who's a very prominent sort of machine learning researcher. And he famously now said that the reason why he's not worried about that singularity where the machines take over is the same reason that he's not worried about overpopulation on Mars. And if I'm misattributing this, Andrew, I'm sorry. But there you go. And I think there's a lot of depth to that quote. There's a lot of truth to that quote. In my personal view, we're so far away from machines being able to develop any sort of ability like that. I mean, we're much closer to the Daleks, you know, that couldn't fly, the ones that can't get upstairs, right, than sort of the Terminators of the world. You know, I think it's right and proper that we ask ourselves those questions, that we think very, very carefully about what situations we put these machines into, absolutely. But I think we shouldn't approach this sort of subject from a point of view of fear, of worry about them taking over. I think first and foremost, we should look at how we can utilize this for the benefit of all of us. And, you know, autonomous driving is, of course, one of those aspects where we look at that and say, yes, absolutely, this will make, hopefully, many people's lives better. But the worry that machines will take over anytime soon is not one at the forefront of my worry.
That's it, that's all. This podcast was brought to you by Oxford Sparks for the University of Oxford, with music by John Lyons. And a special thanks to all of our experts, Neil Ashton, Colin Wilson, Eleanor Stride, Jason Nurse, and Ingmar Posner. Tell us what you think of this podcast. You can go to Twitter, tweet at Oxford Sparks. You can find us on Facebook, or even better, you go on the old internet machine, type in oxfordsparks.ox.ac.uk. Boom, there's our website. I'm Emily Elias, and until next time on the podcast, when we ask, how did Soviet and Western mathematicians communicate in the Cold War? Bye for now.